be a good designer, you have to keep your eyes open. You have to understand your consumer. You have to understand the woman that you are addressing. And obviously, the woman that I address today is a very different woman than the woman when I started the business. But, you know, fashion is illusions. The project of that illusion and how good you are at projecting that illusion.
Fashion designer Oscar De La Renta in an interview with New York Magazine in 2013. The beloved designer died yesterday at the age of 82. De La Renta was known for his timelessly beautiful yet wearable garments, dresses that defined red carpet style. Jennifer Lawrence and Amy Adams are just some of his devoted followers. First ladies turned to him ever since his ensembles helped crown Jackie O as a fashion icon. Joining us now to talk about the life and the work of Oscar De La Renta is fashion journalist Kate Betts. She's held top positions at Vogue and Harper's Bazaar and is the author of Everyday Icon, Michelle Obama and the Power of Style. It is so nice to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with the question for the ages. What is Oscar De La Renta's legacy?
You know, I think his legacy really is that he made women look so beautiful and look comfortable and beautiful as themselves, not necessarily trying to chase fashion trends. He really understood, I think, more than any American designer, this idea that style is about so much more than what you are wearing. It's really about how you live and how you present yourself and how you feel about yourself. And I think that that really came through not only in his clothes and his collections, but his own personality, you know, his own exuberance and elegance and his love of women and his loyalty to his clients and the women that he dressed.
Yeah, the integrity and staying true to yourself. And he stayed very true to his own taste and his own aesthetic. And that brings me to the other question for the ages. What was with him in taffeta? I mean, really, it is the loudest and the stiffest thing to wear.
Well, I mean, I think he loved the idea of these beautiful, voluminous ball gowns and kind of, as I said before, the sort of exuberance of femininity. And he was trained in the European tradition of couture, you know. He first left the Dominican Republic to go to Madrid, actually, to study painting. And that's where he kind of got into this idea of sketching for fashion houses in Spain. And then he moved to Paris to be an assistant for, you know, some of the greatest designers there.
Oh, he was such a Renaissance man and such a model gentleman. Was that his upbringing? What can you tell us about his early life?
I think his upbringing was very much in this sort of European tradition of being a gentleman, you know, and that really was his elegance and his kind of manners. But he also had this great sense of humor, and he wasn't stuck in a nostalgic time either. You know what I mean? I think for somebody of his age and his experience and the span of his career, he was always kind of looking forward and finding new clients and adapting to the new ways of the fashion business. And he was pretty modern that way, which I also think is interesting when you look at somebody of his background.
It's true. He was full of contradictions in a way, as well as being very consistent. He didn't make shock pieces, but he was always concerned that people could wear, that women could wear his garments, their wearability. And I think it's interesting that he cared so much that clothes be wearable, but he never made casual clothing. You know, he said he couldn't do casual, right?
Yeah, I think evening wear is really his legacy. But then again, I mean, when you look at the way that he dressed first ladies, and I think the two that are most interesting to look at, the way that he dressed Laura Bush and the way that he dressed Hillary Clinton and the way that he helped them. I mean, they were two first ladies who weren't necessarily embracing the sort of style icon part of the job. And I think he really helped them in very different ways find their own style and find their own image and feel comfortable with it and feel 100% themselves. And that's, you know, that's really the role of the designer in a very traditional sense.
Well, it was a very interesting take, too, on a casual formal style. It seemed to merge those two things. If you think of Jackie O, her style was always, it had a touch of casual, yet it was so elegant.
Well, I think also, I mean, I don't know it was very simple. You know, I mean, the clothing that she actually wore was very simple. They were simple shift dresses. And that's, in a way, what Oscar did for first ladies like Hillary Clinton. He really simplified her look down to a pantsuit, you know. And then he also created some stunning, beautiful evening dresses for her. So I think that's a very difficult, most designers can't do both things, you know. So I think he had that kind of ambidextrous ability to really pull out the personality of the woman who was wearing his clothes, but also to have a very consistent style himself.
Well, he's talked about as a quintessentially American designer, yet he has this European background. What do you think is so quintessentially American about his designs?
Well, I think his designs have this incredible femininity, and I think, in a way, that's very American. I mean, I think he really wanted women, even if they were wearing a ball gown that had, you know, three tiers of taffeta and was bright pink, he wanted them to feel as comfortable in that as they would in a sweater and a pair of pants, you know, and I think that's a very American notion of fashion.
Well, who do you think picks up where De La Renta left off? Who shows his most direct influence and is taking it to a modern place?
Well, I think he does, you know, he has very recently put into place somebody to run his design studio, Peter Copping. So that's, you know, that's the literal person who's going to take up the mantle of the house of Oscar De La Renta. But I think he did, you know, inspire a whole new generation of young designers like Jason Wu, who also incidentally dresses the First Lady consistently. And I think that they look to him and his craftsmanship and the way that he had these great ateliers and his attention to detail and, you know, the beading and the way that these dresses were constructed was so meticulous. And I think that was very inspirational for a new generation that's coming of age now in the New York fashion firmament and taking their cues from somebody like Oscar De La Renta.
Do you have a favorite piece of Oscar De La Renta's?
Well, it's so hard to choose, but I did think that some of the red carpet dresses that he's done recently, actually, as recently as last spring, Taylor Swift in this sort of blush pink long column dress that she wore to the Costume Institute, or even the dress that Sarah Jessica Parker was wearing that night, which was kind of controversial because it was a white ball gown with a black lattice pattern down the back, and on the train of the dress, he put his own signature, which was kind of bold and, you know, not very
a little flashy
American in a way. I don't know. It was surprising, but I thought it was kind of great. Like, why not, you know?
Why not? Kate Betts, fashion journalist and author of Everyday Icon, Michelle Obama, and The Power of Style. Thank you so much for this. Enjoyed it.
Thank you.
The quarantine is over for 51 people in Texas who were exposed to an Ebola patient. Meanwhile, the two healthcare workers who got the virus while treating Thomas Eric Duncan are still struggling to recover in specialized treatment centers. But the epidemic is still raging in West Africa. So far, it's claimed the lives of more than 4,500 people. And the race is on to find a vaccine or treatment for the deadly virus. For a look at the challenges posed by Ebola, we turn to Kartik Chandran. He's an associate professor of microbiology and immunology at Albert Einstein College of Medicine. And welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Barbara.
Well, let's start with what the current status is of the vaccines in development for Ebola. How many are there and what's showing promise?
Right. To my knowledge, at least three different vaccines that are being tested. The status is that all of these vaccines have been tested in monkeys and they've been shown to be safe as well as to have some efficacy. So now the question is whether they're safe and effective in humans. Just because they are that in monkeys, we can't assume that the same is going to hold true for humans, although, you know, it does make you optimistic.
Let's go back a bit, though, because it sounds as if there's a lot of finger-pointing going on in this story. The NIH researchers reported back in 2000 that they had a promising start on an approach to an Ebola vaccine. And it seems as if the NIH is pointing the finger at the pharmaceutical industry for not pursuing development of a vaccine. There's also a question of NIH federal funding for research being gutted in the past decade. Can you help us understand this blame game and why there isn't a vaccine on the market yet?
Yeah, I'll try. Just putting the politics aside, I think there's really a number of different reasons why we don't have a vaccine. Funding is definitely part of it. Developing a vaccine or a drug is like running a relay race. You know, you have the initial part where you make a basic discovery and then you hand off the baton to a company that tries to take it further. Well, the last leg of this race is the hardest, and that's doing all of the human testing to show that it's safe and effective, and then all of the regulatory things that you need to do to actually have an approved vaccine. That's the part that takes the most amount of money. That's also the part that really requires this complex set of expertises that people in academia, in universities, or in the government don't necessarily have. And if you look at who's been driving the development of this vaccine, it's really been a consortium of scientists in universities, in government, and small companies working together. We don't have the big pharmaceutical company players, which really have all of the expertise in-house to do this, then that do it over and over again. So it's a combination of not having the money to push through and not having the expertise. And I would say that you know, Ebola hasn't been a major public health priority because it causes these rare sporadic outbreaks with only a few people being infected. And one of the challenges with the vaccine is who is the target population for the vaccine? That's never been clear from the start. This virus strikes like lightning and infects and sickens and kills a few people. So it's really the combination of all these different challenges.
So it sounds as if you're saying there are unique challenges to developing a vaccine for Ebola as compared to developing any other vaccine, which is complicated enough.
If you have a virus like the influenza that infects millions of people, then it's pretty clear cut that you should have a vaccine. But with Ebola, where before this epidemic, we've only had these small sporadic outbreaks, you know, that's definitely a harder call. Although, again, these outbreaks have been increasing in frequency in the last 15 years. So I don't think anyone predicted this, saw this coming, but in hindsight, maybe you could say that something like this was inevitable and we should have been ready.
Well, a vaccine that's been effective in monkeys is now being tested on humans, and you study how the virus behaves in humans. So yes. Could you give us an idea of just how much difference there is between how Ebola affects monkeys and how it works in human hosts?
It's actually quite similar, but one of the things that hasn't necessarily been looked at that carefully in terms of research is exactly the ways in which humans and monkeys differ in terms of the virus. But that's not the only issue. The issue is also how our immune systems differ and how we're going to process the vaccine differently. For example, you know, there are examples of drugs that are relatively safe in monkeys but seem to elicit a strong immune response in humans that would be considered unsafe. So it's not just what the virus is doing, it's also what the vaccine is doing.
Well, moving on briefly from vaccines to treatments for Ebola, several patients have received serum, which is centrifuged blood from other patients who survived the virus. How does the treatment work and how well does it work?
So the treatment essentially relies on the fact that survivors produce antibodies against the virus. And so when you transfer plasma or serum from a survivor to a patient, you're giving them this antibody-laden stuff that the antibodies can bind to the virus and neutralize it, can pin it down and prevent it from infecting cells. So that's the principle for really how these blood transfusions work. I think one of the challenges is that not all survivor sera are the same. So if you look at the amount, the quality, and the kinds of antibodies that are made by different survivors, it's wildly different. So, and only the sera from survivors that make a lot of the really good antibodies are presumably going to be effective. So we need some kind of screening process by which we can identify those individuals and then get sera from them on a regular basis and then have that be available to patients. And one of the reasons why this has been difficult in the past is because these transfusions have been done not in a really controlled way, scientifically speaking. So the quality of the sera that's being transferred varies a lot, and so the results also vary a lot.
Well, you're also researching an Ebola drug that works with proteins to stop the virus. How close are you to bringing this to market?
We are actually taking a different tack. So a lot of the things that are under discussion right now, including the ZMAP antibody cocktail, work directly on the virus itself. So what we're doing is we're targeting the host. We're targeting genes, proteins that are in the host that are actually exploited by Ebola to infect cells in our body. And we think that these are excellent targets because the virus can't easily evolve and mutate around these kinds of treatments. But this is still at the lab stage where we're protecting cells from Ebola. We need to get to the point where we can protect animals from Ebola, and we're not there yet. I don't think we're going to have anything from these types of experimental programs ready for this particular epidemic, but we're hopeful that we'll be ready for the next one.
Kartik Chandran, he's Associate Professor of Microbiology and Immunology at Albert Einstein College of Medicine, and thank you very much for taking the time to talk with
Thanks
us
Thanks so much
today.
For having me.
Coming up, Los Angeles hasn't had an NFL team for 20 years. Why should we go back now when sports comes at too high a price? That's next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
And this is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogavin for Madeline Brand. 20 years ago, on Christmas Eve, 1994, the Raiders and Rams both played their last game in Los Angeles. Since then, the second largest media market in the country has not had an NFL team. But there sure has been a lot of talk, and it seems to be heating up again. Today, the LA Times reported that the NFL has started a formal market assessment of the LA area. And two teams have been working hard to make the move happen. You guessed it, the Rams and the Raiders. Word has it, either or both could finalize an agreement with the league as soon as next year. But what's really in it for LA, specifically LA taxpayers? Greg Easterbrook is the author of The King of Sports, Football's Impact on America, recently out in paperback. Hi, Greg.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You are so welcome. So as I just said, there's a lot of buzz about an NFL team coming back to LA and where the stadium would be and which team it would be. From what you're hearing, does it seem like we're really getting closer?
I think the NFL really wants a team in LA. Whether it will happen or not remains to be seen, but that's certainly what they hope to do.
And the Rams and the Raiders were the teams that were last located here, as I said, and they seem to be the front runners now. What's the situation with each of those teams and their efforts to move?
Well, the Raiders are perpetually homeless and also perpetually hopeless. They haven't had a good team in 15 years. So you would think that people would rather have the Rams back. They're closer to winning era than the Raiders are, but the Rams are not exactly hot stuff either. Now, that changes. Talent cycles tend to run 3 to 5 years in the NFL. So 3 to 5 years from now, either of those teams could be fabulous. So to the extent that LA thinks about this, I wouldn't think in terms of which one is the better team. I would think in terms of, does this make sense economically for Los Angeles?
Right. Two teams from 0 to 2. Why would we want that?
Well, would you want any? Would you want two? It would depend on the circumstances, the economic circumstances of their acquisition. If the league or the new owner was paying for their facilities, if there was a new stadium like Phil Anschutz, for example, proposes, or a complete renovation of an existing stadium, if local taxpayers didn't get stuck with the bill, I suppose you'd want NFL teams. It's exciting to have the NFL around in those rare situations where they pay their own way. But the NFL tends not to pay its own way. It tends to demand taxpayer subsidies.
Well, that's right. And you've written a lot about this economic impact of having a franchise. So could you speak more about that, the costs versus the benefits and the tax benefits? Do teams generate a lot of local tax revenue?
Well, they certainly do some, not that much. NFL stadiums tend to be 70% paid for by taxpayers. So let's suppose a new stadium in L.A. would cost $1 billion, or the new one with the last Super Bowl was just played outside New York City costs $1.4 billion. If history is any guide, local taxpayers will face a demand to pay at least 70% of that amount, and then also to exempt the facility from property taxes. The new stadium where the Dallas Cowboys play in, it looks like a flying saucer landed on Earth, is exempt from local property taxes. Now, what's the logical argument? There is no logical argument. It doesn't make any sense at all in free market terms for an enterprise, the NFL, that's making north of $11 billion this year in revenue to have taxpayers pay for its stadia. And it certainly doesn't make any sense to say we want to tax the aircraft industry, we want to tax every kind of industry in Los Angeles except football, which we will exempt from taxation, doesn't make any sense. It's simply what the NFL has traditionally been able to get by political arm twisting, and it's what they'll expect to get in Los Angeles.
So why do cities do it? I mean, where do they get this money? Where do they get the money from to pay for the stadium?
Well, from taxpayers, typically. So take the example of the new stadium that's being built for the Minnesota Vikings, where the Super Bowl will be held in 3 years. The governor of Minnesota, Mark Dayton, who's a Democratic liberal, agreed to give $500 million in taxpayers' money for the construction of that stadium. And you know what his explanation was? Football economics don't make sense in normal terms, which is no explanation. What it means is he didn't want voters saying Governor Dayton is the one who caused the Vikings to move out of Minneapolis. So he gave in for that reason. He's paying with somebody else's money. He doesn't get blamed. L.A., you have a very different situation. You don't have an existing team able to threaten to move if you don't give them $1 billion in subsidies. You don't have any team at all. So you should try to demand a hard bargain of the league or its new owner or both paying for itself.
Yeah, and what would that hard bargain look like? What would you advise city or county officials working with the NFL on bringing a team here to negotiate? And what would you warn them about?
Well, first I would warn you that this dream of, there's going to be so much economic activity created, it'll pay for itself in tax revenue, just isn't true. This is sometimes true of baseball stadiums. There have been studies done comparing baseball to football stadia, and the bottom line is football stadia cost more to build because they're so much bigger and then are only used 10 times a year. If you build a baseball stadium that costs less to build and you use 100 times a year, maybe you do come out in terms of economic activity. But if you have X number of public dollars to invest and you want an economic multiplier, you'll get much better luck with anything in infrastructure, roads, mass transportation, bridges, sewers, etc., than you will with the NFL. Now, if the NFL decides to pay for itself, which would be a very different situation, that would be just fine. A really nice new stadium in the L.A. area, considering your local construction cost, might cost $1.5 billion. The NFL can afford to pay it, and they can afford to pay the same rate of taxation than any other business would pay on a similar property. Bear in mind the economic structure of the NFL is based almost entirely on television revenue. Everybody would like to be in L.A. because everybody loves L.A., but the NFL doesn't need to be in L.A. What it's doing is filming games to broadcast them where 90% of its revenue comes from. Green Bay, Buffalo, Jacksonville. The NFL can make money in very small cities. It's not dependent on ticket sales. So I think that you being Los Angeles, you have the bargaining leverage. You can't be threatened with losing a team because you've already lost your team. And you know that what the NFL wants is the glamour that's associated with the city of Los Angeles as a backdrop for its national telecast. If that's what the NFL wants, they should pay for it themselves.
Well, it might be more likely to snow in L.A. before that happens. Or do you think this call to reform the NFL and its business model and how it moves forward, you think that this reform movement that you're part of, is it gaining traction?
A little bit. Look at the state of Florida. For 3 years, the billionaire who owns the Miami Dolphins has been demanding, first of the city, then of Miami-Dade County, then of the state of Florida, $400 million in public subsidies to renovate his stadium, where his master plan is to keep all the profits from the renovation. All three levels of government have said no. And have the Miami Dolphins moved? Have they vanished? Have they ceased to be a factor in Miami city life? The three levels of government in Florida said no to the Dolphins owner, and he's now paying for it himself. I think if California says no to whichever team may be bound for Los Angeles or says no to the league itself, I think the league will be the one that folds its cards.
Before you go, I am curious. You're such a football fan, and you write about the game, and you watch the game, and you're also really critical of the game. So does that create a kind of inner tug of war for you? Are you a tortured soul?
Oh, no, not really. You know, we're in this polarized culture where you're either for something or against something. And to say that something is really great, but you think it needs extensive reform, that's a harder message. That's how I feel. That's what I just said. It's really great. It needs extensive reform. That's how I feel about the United States of America. And it's also how I feel about football. It's a fabulous game, but it has deep-seated structural problems that need to be addressed.
Okay, we'll leave it at that. Greg Easterbrook is author of The King of Sports, Football's Impact on America, and he writes the Tuesday Morning Quarterback column for ESPN.com. And thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
So does L.A. need the NFL? What do you think? And what team do you think would be a good fit for us? Give us a call, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can join the conversation on Facebook at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, the Taddy, the Punka, the Thermantador, and the apparatus for treating air. We talk to the author of Cool about the weird and wonderful history of air conditioning. That's after this news update from Larry Perel.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Press Play of Barbara Bogavin for Madeline Brand. Here are three questions for you, and they're three questions that all have the same answer. One, what ushered in the age of the internet? Two, what did President Nixon's reelection campaign plan to sabotage during the 1972 Democratic Convention? And three, how can KCRW bring you this broadcast from an underground soundproofed room with no windows, even in the dead of summer? And the answer is air conditioning. Most of us here in L.A., we can't imagine living without it, but it took most Americans a good half of a century to come around to it, and our lives haven't been the same since. All this and more you can read in Salvatore Basil's new book, Cool, How Air Conditioning Changed Everything, and it is a joy to talk with you today.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, you know, something I always wondered, and apparently you wondered it too, because it's your first chapter, how did people cope before air conditioning besides just sweating it out?
They threw up a lot. A number of them actually... a number of them actually died. And in fact, in many cities, there would be every day in the newspapers a careful list, prostrations, deaths, listed by alphabetical names, and where people had fallen and why. And it was just an accepted fact of life that in the summer, a number of people would keel over.
And fall, and they would fall from their roofs, right? They would sleep on the roof to get away from the heat? And
Some of them would try that. And I don't know about L.A. In New York City, we're very much a city of fire escapes. And people would do this well into the 60s and 70s, and probably after, making a bed on your fire escape and padding it out so that you wouldn't roll off.
Well, I'm glad you started on kind of a gross note, because things really did sound worse than even I imagined them to be. For instance, you write about going to the theater before air conditioning, when it was filled with 100 gas lights. Just help us understand what level of Dante's hell that must have been.
Well, a theater was a windowless room, which had not 100, but maybe 1,000 gas lights, because they lit the stage, the auditorium, the great central chandelier, which was the important part of a theater to give sparkle. And all of this created a lot of heat, and the bodies created a lot of heat, and there really wasn't any way to get rid of that heat. So with the buildup of carbon dioxide and the gases that came from the gas lighting, the air would become not only over 100 degrees, but fairly unbreathable. And there were producers who would hand out fans, because otherwise people would faint in the middle of a show and they expected to.
And that's why everyone was carrying around their smelling salts.
Absolutely. Right? It was a great necessity, especially for ladies, because they were so heavily dressed. And wool was a material for a man, even in the summer, no matter how broiling it was. And people were dressed fully, and ladies covered their arms and wore 10 to 12 petticoats. It was an age of a lot of clothing.
Well, throughout the ages, people just sucked it up, right? But as we gathered in more urban spaces and as more inventions came into being, you write that there were a bunch of precursors to modern-day air conditioning, which I had never heard of. Can you tell us some of the more imaginative schemes inventors came up with? And for instance, what were, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, Zephyrifers.
Actually, a Zephyrifer. I've been having such fun with that. I have been having a great deal of fun with that name. I'm so happy I discovered it. That is an early name for an electric fan, just a plain old electric fan as we know it. But people were amazed by this because going back into thousands of years, literally, there were attempts to find some way to create a breeze, an automatic breeze that would keep going. There were Chinese nobles who simply had slave-powered fanning machines. Leonardo da Vinci in the 15th century, I believe, had a machine that was powered by river water to create a spinning fan that would produce cool air to be shunted into the bedchamber of the Countess Beatrice d'Este, who was one of his patrons. In the 18th century, in the Houses of Parliament in London, there was a man who hand-turned a 7-foot ventilating fan, and his title was The Ventilator.
He sounds like a superhero.
I think he was, actually, to those people. But these were all very clumsy systems, and they didn't work well. And it wasn't until the advent of the steam engine that there was a source of power to get these machinery ideas into some sort of usefulness. So many theaters, going back to the theaters as we had mentioned, one of the earlier methods was a theater in New York City called the Madison Square Theater. And the owner had this very elaborate machine that sucked air from the roof, pushed it over 4 tons of ice per night, and distributed it through the theater through about a mile of piping. This was able to keep that theater at 70 degrees even when the city outside was in the 90s. But it was so expensive to operate that the theater went out of business fairly soon. So not many other people tried that method. It wasn't until Willis Carrier invented something called the apparatus for treating air that we had what we know as air conditioning.
And I want to get to that, but I do love hearing about these flops. There was something called the cold air stove, right? The Nevo?
The Nevo, yes. A gentleman who had worked with the U.S. Meteorology Service invented the Nevo, which was a huge, tall canister, about 8 feet tall, which would be charged with what at first was a secret composition. It turned out to be ice and salt. Hot air would be pulled in at the top, and there was a vent for cold air to be pushed out the bottom with a fan. That was the Nevo. It turned out to be clumsy and expensive, and it took hundreds of pounds of ice each day, so people did not go for it.
But it had a wonderful name, which is oven spelled backwards.
Yes, exactly.
I just can't get enough of. And there was a terrible flop in the Chicago Public Library, right? They installed an elaborate ventilating system, and they nailed shut the windows. They were so proud of it and so sure it would work.
Yes, they had, in fact, constructed the building with windows that were designed not to open at all, what they call fixed windows, and put in this air conditioning system, refrigerating system, what they called at the time an air washer. And the air washer was so puny for the space that it did pretty much nothing. So the windows had to be replaced, which cost money. Electric fans, Zephyrifers, had to be bought, and the entire system was scrapped.
Well, it did sound as if something showed promise, but nothing really worked that well. And apparently, this idea that these contraptions just do not provide relief got around and even had its own slang word. People referred to things not giving us, how did they pronounce it, coolth?
Coolth, yes. Yes, in the winter we had warmth, and in the summer we had coolth. And coolth wasn't happening for a lot of people. One of the systems that did work to some extent was at the New York Stock Exchange, which was one of the very first what we would call air-conditioned spaces. A gigantic ammonia refrigeration unit was installed to cool this huge trading floor but it had to be monitored by an engineer who was on premises all the time and, in fact, would walk through the floor, and people would see him with a palm outstretched as if they said he was taking pinches of the air to feel the humidity. Then he would go back and dial things up or down as needed.
A human barometer.
Exactly.
I'm talking with Salvatore Basil. He has a new book called Cool, How Air Conditioning Changed Everything. Well, this takes us up to about 1902, when we get to the invention of modern-day air conditioning. So could you tell us about Willis Carrier and his apparatus for treating air?
Willis Carrier was a very young man. He was in his 20s, and right out of Cornell had snagged a job with a company called the Buffalo Forge Company. They had made blacksmithing equipment, but their bellows were being used by a number of factories to provide ventilation. And there was a printing company in Brooklyn, New York, that was famous for doing color illustrations. And humidity in air was causing the paper to swell, so this company was losing tons of paper and a lot of money in the process. They contacted Buffalo Forge, and Buffalo Forge brought the problem to Willis Carrier. So he analyzed and analyzed and analyzed and ultimately was able to take the machinery that existed and fashion it to something that cooled air and reduced humidity.
And the thing
but
really worked.
It really worked. It required some tinkering, of course. It wasn't an instant success, but it was pretty good. Within 10 years, factories across the United States were using it, but the apparatus for treating air, as he had patented it, was just too large and too custom of a machine to be used in any home. It took literally decades, because to get this technology into a small user-friendly size seemed impossible at first.
Yeah, and what was the catalyst then that brought air conditioning into the mainstream? Because you tell the story of how people were, all puns intended, people went hot and cold on air conditioning. They didn't know what to make of it, and the progress in techniques was stop and go. But it seems that after World War II, this was the age.
It was. Part of the reason was that so many people were living in homes, and so many of the homes were in developments, which meant that they were not very well insulated. The other thing was that the 1950s were a great decade for status symbols. There was nothing as direct as having an air conditioner hanging out of a window. That helped also the fact that window air conditioners had been pretty much settled in the form they would take till this day, and they had dropped in price. They had been hugely expensive when they were first around. They cost what would be in our money $3,000 to $4,000.
And in terms of our regional U.S. economies, what effect did the invention of air conditioning have on, say, Florida and the Sun Belt?
The South definitely needed the boost of air conditioning in order to turn it into a viable financial center, as it is nowadays, because until the age of universal air conditioning, it was not at all. It was far lower in population and definitely in financial status. And by the way, speaking of Florida, this is something that we've noticed just last week in the gubernatorial debates between Charlie Crist and Rick Scott.
Fangate,
yes.
Zephyrigate.
Zephyrifergate, I like this, yes. This brings us to the fact that comfort is a very individual thing and always has been. And one of the things that has gone along with the universal adoption of air conditioning is the almost universal displeasure with air conditioning at one time or another.
Well, it's true. Air conditioning really has gotten bad press, and in many cases for good reason. First there was Freon, and then Legionnaires' disease, and it's contributed to global warming. It's an energy guzzler. There's even some research now that it's making us fat. How is the technology changing to make air conditioning healthier and greener and more sustainable?
The major companies have been doing a huge amount of research on refrigerants that are going to be not only more efficient, but considerably cleaner for the environment. Now, there are some ideas with units, one of which is called a DVAP. This is a system which is being tested right now, which uses a polyester membrane and a saline solution and a pattern of channels and an airflow, and I don't really know much more about it than that, but what I have heard, and I've heard it from the inventors, is that it is possibly going to be able to save 90% of the cost, of the energy cost, of cooling a space.
Interesting. Salvatore Basil, he's the author of Cool, How Air Conditioning Changed Everything. I really enjoyed this. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
I wish you cools.
And I wish you cools as well.
Well, the always cool Warren Alden is here to talk about what's coming up on the show.
Oh, slick transition. Thank you very much.
Smooth.
I appreciate that. We're going to be talking about something even more recently developed than air conditioning, and that is, of course, the internet and the data mining business. 4,000 companies sucking up every piece of information you could possibly imagine, most things that you don't even realize, doing profiles of people, which sometimes have incorrect information in them, people's losing jobs as a result of being on lists that they didn't know they were on. It's all secret. It's very difficult to access. And of course, there are good things about data mining, too. But there are a lot of warning signs, and we're going to look at them.
The devil hidden in data mining. And yeah, air conditioning made the internet possible and those
indeed
computers. So it all comes back to cool. Oh, that's great. And that's coming up on To the Point with Warren Olney at 1 o'clock. Coming up on our show, though, 2014 is almost over and no album has gone platinum yet. Oh, wait, come again. What is an album anyway? What will it take to bring the music industry into the digital age? And that's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogavin from Madeline Brand. The three top albums of 2014 are everywhere. Every kid in the country is singing along to the soundtrack to the animated movie Frozen.
The snow glows white on the mountain tonight, not a footprint to be seen.
There's also Beyoncé's eponymous LP.
Drunk in love, we'd be on.
And Lorde's first album, Pure Heroine.
But every song's like gold teeth, gray goose dripping in the bathroom, bloodstains, ball gowns, trash in the hotel room, we don't care.
But all three of those albums were released last year. No album released so far this year is on track to sell more than a million copies in the U.S. Now, a few upcoming releases, Taylor Swift's 1989 for one, could likely hit the mark. But even so, the trend is unmistakable. A decade ago, something like 25 albums looked like they'd go platinum. Mark Mulligan is a media and technology analyst and co-founder of Media Consulting. Hi, Mark.
Hello there.
Well, could you lay it out for us? Why are mega-selling albums becoming a thing of the past, if they indeed are becoming a thing of the past?
Well, the harsh reality is, yes, they are becoming a thing of the past, and there's a couple of really big reasons. One is we're just buying less music than we used to. Ever since the emergence of Napster right at the end of the 90s, music sales have gone into decline. People buy fewer albums. People tend to pick albums apart and buy singles. And then a growing number of people just don't buy music at all. Added to that there's more music being released than ever, what you've got is essentially a smaller pie being cut up into an even greater number of smaller slices.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. But I keep seeing headlines like, this is the death of the platinum album and recording industry in its death throes. There's so much death, but there's still so much money changing hands. So is this just media hype?
So there's more money being spent on music now than there was back when the CD market and the album was, you know, at its peak in around about 2000, 2001. And that is because people are spending their money on music in different ways. Before Napster, before the internet, music was a scarce thing. You had to go and buy music from the shops, in the mall, and that was your only choice, apart from listening to the radio or making a poor quality cassette copy. now we're inundated with different places that we can get music, and paying for it is, you know, is a lifestyle choice. Yet there are many things which are still scarce that we still really value. If you want to go see your favorite artist live, that is something you can only do by paying for it. And people buy merchandise, people buy special limited editions. So people are spending lots of money on music. They're just not spending as much of it on albums.
Well, if then we're not seeing the end of the music industry, are we seeing the end of the album?
We're not seeing the end of the music industry. We're seeing the emergence of a new music industry. And where is the days of really big selling albums is becoming increasingly something of the past. The album as a creative format isn't going to disappear. That's just going to change. And it's changed a huge amount over over its history. It first emerged, the name album comes from originally when people had an album, it was a collection of individual gramophone discs which were put together in a wooden holder called an album, like a photograph album. And, you know, since then we'd had vinyl albums in the 70s where they were typically only 8 songs because you could only fit 4 on either side of a vinyl. Then along came the CD and we ended up fitting in 14, 15 songs. Now in the digital era with iTunes LPs, we're getting videos and photos and interactive elements and that. So the album as a creative construct is going to be here to stay. It's just going to look and feel very different from the album of the 90s and the noughties.
Well, I'm thinking that conventional wisdom is that streaming is changing everything and it plays into this whole album controversy. But how big a part of the music industry revolution are streaming services like Pandora and Spotify? And is it really changing everything?
So there is no doubt that streaming is going to be, and I emphasize is going to be rather than is going to be the biggest change that the music industry has ever had. This is way bigger than the shift to the download. The download was just another way of buying music. You know, so you could still have record labels and artists and everything else still behaving the same way as they did with the CD and with LPs and 8-tracks. It was still the idea of shifting units of stuff. It simply happened to be digital units of stuff. Now, though, with streaming, it's all about consumption. People don't even have to pay. And you end up with completely different economics, completely different behavior, much quicker hits, but much more short-lived hits as well. So, yet, the actual percentage of people who pay for services like Rhapsody and Spotify in the US is about 5 or 6%. It's a tiny little part of the audience. Pandora is obviously much bigger. That is essentially just radio. It's radio with a twist. And so, you know, I think we're still a long way off yet from streaming absolutely transforming the music industry, but that will happen.
And getting back to this platinum idea, what happens if we go a few years without an album hitting platinum? Will we get a whole new prize? And I was trying to think of one.
All I was going to say was I think there's a really simple thing you do. You just put in a bit of devaluation and suddenly you only need 500,000 sales to make it platinum.
Oh, there you go. Problem solved. Record industry, take note. So who are the winners and losers in these changes and in this evolution of streaming?
Well,
it seems like artists are always on the losing end. But
yeah, so absolutely for sure. Artists, but not every type of artist. So there are lots of artists talking out against streaming at the moment, and you know, for some very good reasons. But they tend not to be the big, super successful artists, of, it tends not to be the Taylor Swifts and the Beyoncés. It tends to be artists who either are a bit beyond their peak or artists who haven't yet really broken through. And the artists who are a bit beyond the peak, the reason it hits them is because they're seeing two things. One is they got famous in the days when he did make megabucks from selling platinum albums, so they're used to big royalty checks. But they're also confusing a bit the fact that sales are declining with their careers declining, and it's very difficult to separate those two out. For up-and-coming artists, though, it is actually really difficult to make ends meet if you're relying purely on music sales, because a stream, you can typically need maybe 100, 200 or more streams, depending what deal you're on, in order to make the same amount of money you would get from one download. So artists have to rely on playing live to make it, to pay the bills.
Mark Mulligan. He's a media and technology analyst and co-founder of Media Consulting, and he blogs at musicindustryblog.wordpress, and I really appreciate talking with you today. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Jolie Myers, always platinum in my heart.
500,000 people listening right now. That makes us platinum, according to our devaluation scale.
Thank you, Mark Mulligan.
Thanks, Mark Mulligan. So I love that this job gives me the opportunity to get nosy about our listeners' tastes.
As if you ever decline that opportunity, but go ahead.
Yeah, now I just have a reason. It's state sanctioned. We asked what the last entire album was that people picked up.
Oh.
A few of my favorites. Gilles Ette on Facebook says he bought a Kids Incorporated album way back in 1989. Something tells me that one didn't go platinum back then. Thomas Bunce picked up a more recent release, Passive Me, Aggressive You by The Naked and Famous. And Christian Monday snapped up a KCRW favorite the other day at Amoeba, Hozier's new LP. Christian, do yourself a favor and check out the live set he did on Morning Becomes Eclectic a few months back. It was totally stellar. You can find that at our website, kcrw.com.
And that's awesome. Thank you so much, Jolie. And that's all the time we have today for Press Play. You can always join the conversation on Twitter at KCRW Press Play or on Facebook at KCRW.com. No, KCRW Press Play. And it was such a pleasure joining you today. Stay tuned for Warren Olney on To the Point at 1 o'clock.